All right, so today we're diving deep into a period of history. It's often overlooked, but it's actually super important for understanding the New Testament.
Right.
We're talking about those 400 years between the Old and New Testaments, the intertestamental period.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. What's so fascinating about this era is that it's a time of immense change for the Jewish people.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, empires rise and fall, cultures clash, and religious ideas evolve constantly. It's like this melting pot of influences that directly shaped the world Jesus was born into and where he did his ministry.
And to help us navigate this complicated period, we're going to use a unique structure.
Okay.
We'll follow the empires that ruled over Israel, just like in Dr. Robert C. Newman's lecture.
Makes sense.
First up, Palestine, under the Persians.
Yeah.
Roughly from 539 to 331 BC. Can you imagine what it must have been like for the Jewish people to finally return to their homeland after decades of exile in Babylon?
It was a monumental event.
It must have been.
And it wouldn't have been possible without Cyrus the Great. He was unlike previous rulers. Cyrus had this revolutionary policy of religious tolerance.
I've heard that.
You know, he actually allowed deported people to return to their homelands and rebuild their temples.
Wow.
That was unheard of in ancient Near Eastern politics.
That's amazing. It must have been an incredible mix of emotions, joy at returning home, the immense challenge of rebuilding a society from scratch, and I bet a bit of anxiety about the future, too.
For sure. And it's important to remember, this wasn't just about putting bricks and mortar back together.
It was a whole revival.
It was about reviving their culture, their faith, their entire identity after such a traumatic period.
Absolutely. And the second temple built during this period wasn't just a replacement for Solomon's temple. It became a powerful symbol of Jewish resilience and a center for their religious and communal life.
That's right.
Speaking of reviving religious life, we can't forget Ezra and Nehemiah.
Yeah.
Ezra, a priest and scholar, worked tirelessly to restore observance of the law, while Nehemiah, a skilled administrator, focused on rebuilding Jerusalem's walls. But why was rebuilding the walls so important?
Good question. Rebuilding the walls wasn't just about physical security.
Gotta
remember, Jerusalem had been reduced to a village under Babylonian rule.
Oh, yeah.
Refortifying it transformed the city. It became a symbol of strength and autonomy, a powerful message for the Jewish people and their neighbors.
It's amazing how these physical structures carry such deep symbolic meaning, isn't it?
Totally.
Okay, here's where things take an interesting linguistic turn. During the Persian period, we see Aramaic emerging as a common language among Jews.
Uh-huh.
Think about it. Aramaic became so widespread that some people even needed it to understand their own sacred texts.
It's a great example of how cultural exchange can leave a lasting impact even on religious practices.
For sure.
Aramaic, originally adopted during the exile, became so integrated into Jewish life that they developed oral translations called Targums. Yeah, they used them in synagogues to help people understand the Hebrew scriptures.
That must have been a pretty significant shift. Imagine needing a translation to understand your own religious texts. It speaks volumes about the adaptability of faith communities. And speaking of adapting, this period also saw the rise of the synagogue.
Right.
It was initially intended as a supplement to the temple for those unable to travel to Jerusalem.
Right.
But eventually it became the primary place of Jewish worship.
It's fascinating how something that starts as a temporary solution can become a defining institution, isn't it? The synagogue, with its focus on prayer and study rather than temple sacrifices, ended up reshaping Jewish religious practice and communal life in a way no one could have predicted.
It really highlights how periods of challenge and change can lead to incredible innovation. Well, that brings us to the end of the Persian period. Next up, we'll be exploring the impact of the Greeks on Palestine.
Perfect.
Alexander the Great, Hellenism, philosophical debates, we've got a lot to unpack. Ready to dive into the next chapter.
Absolutely. Alexander's conquests had a massive impact on the ancient world. The spread of Greek culture, known as Hellenism, had a lasting legacy on Jewish society. But it wasn't a simple story of domination. There was resistance, adaptation, and even some fascinating tales of Alexander's encounters with Jewish prophecies. We'll delve into all of that in the next part of our deep dive. Okay, so let's talk about Alexander the Great. He wasn't just this military genius. He was driven by this vision of a unified world, like a fusion of East and West.
I can see why he's such a pivotal figure in our story.
Right, and that vision really helped to spread Hellenism far and wide, but it wasn't just about imposing Greek culture.
No, it also led to some really interesting cultural exchanges.
Yeah, exactly.
I've heard some intriguing, albeit debated, stories about Alexander's encounter with the Jewish high priest, and even prophecies about him in the book of Daniel.
Yeah.
What's the real story there?
Well, the story goes that when Alexander approached Jerusalem, he was met by the Jewish high priest.
No.
And the priest showed Alexander the book of Daniel, which, as you know, contains prophecies about a Greek king who would conquer the Persian Empire. And according to the story, Alexander was so impressed by this that he spared Jerusalem.
Wow.
And treated the Jews favorably. Now, historians debate the accuracy of this account, but it illustrates this complex relationship between Alexander and the Jewish people.
That's a great example of how legends and historical accounts can sometimes intertwine.
Totally.
It definitely adds another layer to the story. So we've got this massive empire, but then Alexander dies unexpectedly at the young age of 33. What happens next?
Well, without a clear heir, his empire just fractures.
Oh, wow.
His generals engage in this huge power struggle. And, you know, for our deep dive, the most important players are Ptolemy and Seleucus.
Mm-hmm.
Ptolemy takes control of Egypt, while Seleucus gains this huge chunk of territory in the north, including parts of Asia Minor and Mesopotamia.
So how did these new rulers treat the Jewish people in Palestine? Was it more the same, or did things change?
Well, the Ptolemies, who controlled Palestine for about a century, were relatively tolerant toward the Jews.
Oh, okay.
They allowed a degree of autonomy and even encouraged Jewish settlement in Alexandria, which became this major center of Jewish learning and culture. It was during this time that the famous Library of Alexandria was established, which housed a vast collection of Jewish texts, including early versions of the Septuagint.
Wait, the Septuagint? Isn't that the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible?
Ooh, got it.
What's the connection there?
You're exactly right. The Septuagint is considered the oldest extensive translation of any ancient work.
It's huge.
And it played this crucial role in shaping both Jewish and Christian understanding of the scriptures. It's believed to have originated in Alexandria during this period of Ptolemaic rule, likely commissioned by Ptolemy II for his library.
So this translation wasn't just a scholarly endeavor. It was a reflection of the cultural exchange happening under the Ptolemies.
Yeah.
That's incredible. But I have a feeling things are about to get a bit less peaceful with the arrival of the Seleucid dynasty.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
You are spot on.
Oh, good.
The Seleucids, who wrestled control of Palestine from the Ptolemies, were far less accommodating.
Oh, boy.
One ruler in particular, Antiochus V Epiphanes, becomes a central figure in this story. He aggressively tried to impose Hellenism on the Jewish people, sparking a clash of cultures and a violent revolt.
I've heard of Antiochus V Epiphanes. His name means God manifest, but the Jewish people called him Epimenes, meaning madman.
Exactly.
That tells you everything you need to know about how well that went over.
Antiochus V's attempts to suppress Jewish practices, you know, like circumcision and kosher dietary laws, and his desecration of the temple by dedicating it to Zeus, were met with fierce resistance.
Wow.
This ultimately led to the Maccabean Revolt, one of the most pivotal moments in Jewish history.
The Maccabean Revolt, it's a story of courage, resistance, and the fight for religious freedom. We're talking about guerrilla warfare, unlikely victories, and the rededication of the temple, which we still celebrate today as Hanukkah. This is where things get really interesting.
It really is a captivating story.
It is.
It all begins with this aged priest named Mattathias.
Okay.
He becomes the catalyst for the revolt. When Seleucid officials arrived in his village of Modin demanding that the inhabitants participate in pagan sacrifices, Mattathias refused.
And for him.
And killed both a fellow villager who was about to comply and the Seleucid official.
Wow. That's a powerful statement.
Yeah.
He wasn't messing around. What happened next? Did people join him in his revolt?
Absolutely. Mattathias and his five sons fled to the hills, calling on others to join them in armed resistance, and thus began a guerrilla war against a seemingly insurmountable foe.
And it's Mattathias' son Judah who becomes a legendary figure in this revolt. He earns the nickname Maccabee, which means the hammer.
Right.
I love that.
Judah Maccabee proved to be this brilliant military strategist. Using hit-and-run tactics and exploiting their knowledge of the terrain, the Maccabees inflicted a series of defeats on the Seleucid forces. Their success inspired others to join their ranks, and their momentum continued to build.
It's a classic underdog story.
Yeah.
I bet people were thrilled to see them succeeding against such a powerful empire.
So they eventually retook Jerusalem and reclaimed the temple, right?
They did.
Okay, good.
But the story doesn't end there.
Oh, no.
The Seleucids attempted to regain control, and tragically, Judah Maccabee was killed in battle in 160 BC. His brothers, Jonathan and Simon, continue the fight for independence. They proved to be skilled diplomats as well as military leaders, capitalizing on divisions within the Seleucid Empire to secure greater autonomy for Judea.
It sounds like they had to be really clever to navigate that political landscape. But sadly, I'm guessing their story doesn't have a happy ending either.
Unfortunately, you're right. Both Jonathan and Simon were assassinated, which really highlights the volatile political atmosphere of the time. Their efforts, however, laid the foundation for the Hasmonean dynasty, named after an ancestor of the Maccabees.
So this is where we see a period of Jewish independence, right? Tell me more about the Hasmonean dynasty.
The Hasmonean dynasty, which lasted from 134 to 63 BC, was a time of expansion and consolidation.
Okay, the Hasmonean kingdom grew to encompass territories once ruled by David and Solomon.
That's amazing.
It was a remarkable achievement, a testament to the military and political acumen of leaders like John Hyrcanus. But it was also a time of growing internal divisions.
You're talking about the rise of the Pharisees and Sadducees, right?
Yeah.
They had very different interpretations of Jewish law and tradition.
Exactly.
Didn't their rivalry play a role in the eventual downfall of the Hasmonean dynasty?
Exactly. The Pharisees, who were popular among the common people, emphasized strict observance of the law and believed in the resurrection. The Sadducees, often associated with the priestly aristocracy, were more pragmatic and skeptical of certain doctrines, like the resurrection. Their rivalry, combined with power struggles within the Hasmonean family, weakened the dynasty and made Judea vulnerable to outside forces.
So it sounds like internal divisions paved the way for, yet again, another empire to come in and take control.
Yes, a power vacuum, combined with the strategic importance of Judea, made it ripe for Roman conquest. It all began with this fateful appeal to Rome for help in settling a dispute between two Hasmonean brothers, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II.
Wow.
They were vying for the throne.
And as we often see in history, what starts as an invitation for assistance quickly turns into an excuse for conquest.
Precisely. Rome, under the leadership of Pompey the Great, seized the opportunity to establish control over Judea in 63 BC. And so begins a new and turbulent chapter in Jewish history, Palestine under the Romans.
I'm already sensing this isn't going to end well for the Jewish people.
Yeah.
But before we dive into that, I'm curious about something you mentioned earlier, the rise of messianic expectations.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. During this tumultuous period with empires rising and falling and the Jewish people facing constant threats to their way of life, there was this growing hope for a divinely appointed leader who would deliver them from oppression and usher in a new era of peace and justice.
So this messianic hope, fueled by political turmoil and probably influenced by interpretations of Daniel's prophecies, played a significant role in shaping the context in which Jesus emerged.
Exactly. It's crucial to understand that Jesus arrived on the scene in a world already saturated with these messianic expectations. Different groups like the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes each had their own interpretations of what the messianic age would look like and what role the Messiah would play.
This raises some fascinating questions. How did those varied expectations shape the way people responded to Jesus' message? What hopes and fears did he embody for different segments of Jewish society?
Those are excellent questions.
They really are.
And they're key to understanding the complexities of the New Testament narrative. But to answer them fully, we need to delve into the next chapter of our deep dive, where we'll explore Palestine under Roman rule, the rise of Herod the Great, and ultimately the events leading up to the destruction of the Second Temple.
Last time, we left off with the Romans marching into Judea and the Jewish people finding themselves, yet again, under foreign rule. But before we dive into that, you mentioned the rise of messianic expectations. Can you paint a clearer picture of what those expectations look like?
Yeah. So imagine living in a time of constant upheaval, your homeland under the thumb of a foreign power. It's only natural to yearn for a savior, a leader who could restore freedom and usher in a new era of peace and prosperity.
So people were looking for someone to liberate them, not just spiritually, but politically as well.
Exactly. The concept of the Messiah, a divinely appointed king who would restore the Davidic dynasty and establish God's kingdom on earth, was deeply ingrained in Jewish thought. But the interpretations of what that meant in practical terms varied widely.
So you're saying there wasn't one unified picture of what the Messiah would be like or what he would do?
Precisely. Some groups, like the Zealots, believed the Messiah would be a military leader who would violently overthrow Roman rule. Others, like the Pharisees, focused more on the spiritual and moral renewal that the Messiah would bring. And there were groups like the Essenes who withdrew from mainstream society altogether, believing they were living in the end times and awaiting the Messiah's imminent arrival.
It's fascinating how these different interpretations reflect the diversity of Jewish thought and experience during this period. So, how did the Romans, with their own ideas about power and authority, fit into this mix?
Well, the Romans, of course, were not interested in fostering Jewish messianic hopes. They were focused on maintaining control and stability in their vast empire. They appointed a series of rulers, including Herod the Great, to govern Judea.
Ah, Herod the Great. He's a figure who definitely left his mark on history. Known for his ambition, ruthlessness, and some pretty impressive building projects, like the renovation in the Second Temple. But I've also heard he wasn't exactly popular among the Jewish people.
Herod was a complex figure. He was a shrewd politician who managed to maintain a delicate balance between appeasing the Romans and placating the Jewish population. He undertook massive construction projects, including the expansion and beautification of the Second Temple, which was seen as a way to bolster his legitimacy among the Jews.
So it sounds like he was trying to win over the people, at least to some extent, but I can't imagine it was easy being a Jewish king under Roman rule.
It was a constant balancing act. Herod was constantly under suspicion from the Romans, who saw him as a potential threat, and he was also wary of his own people, many of whom resented him as a Roman puppet.
It sounds like a recipe for disaster. And wasn't this also a time of growing unrest and resistance against Roman rule?
Yes, tensions continued to simmer, fueled by Roman taxation policies, cultural insensitivity, and the presence of Roman troops in Jerusalem. The Zealots, who advocated for armed rebellion against Rome, became increasingly influential, and all of this eventually culminated in the first Jewish revolt in 66 AD.
So this is where the story takes a tragic turn. What were the key events of this revolt?
The first Jewish revolt was a brutal and bloody conflict that lasted for 4 years. The Zealots played a key role, taking control of Jerusalem and fighting fiercely against the Romans. But the Romans, under the command of Vespasian and later his son Titus, were a formidable force. They eventually laid siege to Jerusalem, and in 70 AD, the city fell. The Second Temple, the heart of Jewish religious and national identity, was destroyed.
The destruction of the temple must have been a devastating blow, not just physically, but also spiritually. How did the Jewish people cope with such a profound loss?
It was a period of immense trauma and upheaval. Many Jews were killed or displaced, and those who remained had to find ways to rebuild their lives and their faith without the temple. This is where we see the emergence of Rabbinic Judaism.
Rabbinic Judaism, what does that mean?
It's a form of Judaism that shifts the focus away from temple sacrifices and toward the study and interpretation of the Torah. Rabbis, who were scholars and teachers of Jewish law, emerged as the new religious leaders. They established academies where they debated and codified Jewish law and tradition, creating a framework for Jewish life that could exist without the temple.
So it was a time of profound loss, but also of resilience and adaptation. Did this new form of Judaism completely replace temple-based practices?
Not entirely. There were still those who clung to the hope that the temple would be rebuilt and that the traditional sacrificial system would be restored. And this yearning for the restoration of the temple played a role in the second Jewish revolt, also known as the Bar Kokhba revolt, which erupted in 132 AD.
What sparked the second revolt?
Emperor Hadrian, who ruled Rome at the time, had plans to build a pagan city on the site of Jerusalem, and this was seen as a profound insult to the Jewish people, and it reignited the flames of rebellion. The revolt was led by Simon Bar Kokhba, who was proclaimed by some, including the prominent Rabbi Akiva, as the Messiah.
It sounds like there was this desperate hope that this time they could achieve true independence and restore their sacred space. But sadly, I'm guessing it didn't end well.
Unfortunately, you're right. The Bar Kokhba revolt was brutally crushed by the Romans in 135 AD. The consequences for the Jewish people were severe, with further loss of life, displacement, and restrictions on access to Jerusalem.
It's heartbreaking to think about the suffering they endured. So where does that leave us? What's the big takeaway from all of this?
Well, I think the intertestamental period is a testament to the resilience of the Jewish people. Despite facing constant upheaval, foreign domination, and the destruction of their most sacred space, they found ways to adapt to preserve their faith and to create new forms of religious expression.
And we can't forget the impact of this period on the development of Christianity. Jesus emerged in a world already steeped in messianic expectations, and his message resonated with those who were yearning for liberation, both spiritual and political.
Exactly. Understanding the intertestamental period is essential for grasping the historical and religious context of the New Testament. It's not just a gap between two testaments. It's a bridge that connects the ancient world of the Hebrew Bible to the emergence of Christianity.
So by understanding this bridge, we gain a richer appreciation for the world in which Jesus lived, taught, and ultimately change the course of history. It's a reminder that to fully understand the present, we need to delve into the complexities of the past.
Well said. It's a reminder that history isn't just a collection of dates and events. It's a tapestry of human experiences, struggles, and triumphs. And by exploring these stories, we gain insights into our own lives and the world around us.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the intertestamental period. We hope you've gained a new perspective on this often overlooked but crucial era in history.
And until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.